The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Robert J. Steigman presiding.
Good morning, counsel. Our first case today, excuse me, it's 424-0788, Jarrett versus Bond et al. Ask for counsel for the appellant, please state your name.
Good morning. My name is Brett Cole.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for the appellee, please state your name.
Good morning. My name is Zane Smith.
Okay, and as I think you know, counsel, each of you will be given 20 minutes to argue, and then the appellant will be given a 5-minute rebuttal. With that, Mr. Cole, on behalf of the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. I'm here today to ask the court to reverse the trial court's order of contempt and order to produce a document privileged under the Illinois Medical Studies Act. The issues on appeal are first whether the September 21st peer review letter contains statements concerning the mechanisms of a peer review committee and whether the letter's contents should have been deemed privileged under the Illinois Medical Studies Act. And the answer is yes. Second, whether the events described in the September 21st peer review letter occurring in a different place and 10 years after the events at issue in this case were so remote that there was not sufficient potential that the letter would lead to relevant evidence. And the answer to that is yes. And third, whether the trial court's order of contempt should be vacated. And the answer is yes. I'll first go into the trial court's determination of the contents of the letter and whether those contents related to the mechanisms of a peer review under the Illinois Medical Studies Act. The manifest weight of the evidence suggests that the letter should be privileged. The Medical Studies Act standard privilege applies to material used by the peer review committee or other credentialing body of the hospital in the course of internal quality control. And the letter of September 21st, 2023 includes information regarding internal quality control. And I point to the Artisana case that says exempt material is limited to material exempt from the Medical Studies Act privilege is limited to ultimate decisions or actions by a hospital. Mere recommendations and internal conclusions of a peer review committee, medical executive committee are privileged under the Medical Studies Act. And that's where the substance of the September 21st, 2023 letter falls.
Mr. Cole, may I ask, it sounds like the committee's work concluded with this letter, but there was at least one and perhaps two steps that would have to occur before Dr. Bond's privileges were actually revoked. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. There was approval by the hospital board of directors. The medical executive committee had met and made a recommendation to the board. And the next step in that process would be a decision by the hospital's board of directors.
And unless he requested a hearing, that would also be an interim step.
Correct. And ultimately, the decision of the medical executive committee, the recommendation of the medical executive committee, was not heeded. Dr. Bonds remained privileged at those institutions at the conclusion of this and at the time of the court's order.
So isn't that what is discoverable under the Medical Studies Act, not the process, but the outcome?
That's correct. And anything that shines light on the process is privileged under the act. And I would say that this letter is privileged in its entirety because on its face, it says this isn't the final step. This isn't the final determination. If you were to alternatively view this in a way that the committee's decision is the final step, which I would disagree with, even under those circumstances, the contents of this letter make reference to materials reviewed by the committee, occurrences that were brought under review by the committee, and those aspects of the process are privileged. I believe the letter ought to be privileged in its entirety because it includes nothing but internal quality control information. And the Artisana case is really on point with that. This is not an ultimate decision or an ultimate conclusion. It's an internal recommendation. The hospital's board of directors had not weighed in on it, and ultimately the recommendation was not heeded. The document establishes by its own content that it was a part of a peer review process, and it establishes by its own content that those are recommendations, not ultimate conclusions. And I think what Justice Doherty mentioned about the ultimate conclusion is brought forth in the Richter case. The ways and means are privileged. The ways and means of a medical executive committee, the ways and means of any peer review process are privileged, but the results, the ultimate results, are not. And in this case, the ultimate results were inconsistent with this letter, and the letter was part of the middle, the ways and the means of the medical executive committee in reaching its recommendations. The Roach case is also instructive. It required that material must have been generated for the purpose of peer review, not for any other reason. This letter was generated for the purpose of peer review, not for any other reason. There's not anything. I don't believe there's any dispute about that. However, the appellee's brief makes some reference to, oh, there's more material to be disclosed. All that's at issue in this appeal is the September 21st, 2016 letter, which makes reference to the process of peer review.
So my question is, where did the trial court go wrong in your judgment and its analysis in this case?
I believe the trial court erred by making the determination that the September 21st, 2023 letter was a final determination, was an ultimate conclusion of a peer review process. I disagree that it was an ultimate conclusion of a peer review process, and the trial court had the information that was needed to know that this was not the ultimate conclusion of the peer review process, because the privileges at issue were reinstated isn't the correct word, but the recommendation that was made in the September 21st, 2023 letter was not heeded by the hospital, and was therefore not an ultimate conclusion. And the Anderson case, even material produced outside of peer review but ordered by peer review may be privileged. Again, this letter is squarely within the parameters of an Illinois Medical Studies Act privilege. Partial plans are not ultimate decisions. Those are privileged. That was part of the Anderson holding as well. And in the Toth case, the appellate court found error from the trial court in ordering internal peer review documents to be disclosed. This is right along those lines as well. This is an internal peer review document. Now, there are some constraints that plaintiff brought up, and I believe were also referenced in the appellant's brief. Nielsen suggests that no privilege exists when material is generated in anticipation of peer review. That's not applicable here. The Chicago Trust case says documents at issue were not established.
You said in anticipation of peer review. Did you mean in anticipation of litigation?
Oh, perhaps.
Okay.
In the Chicago Trust case, documents that were at issue in that case were not established as being part of the peer review committee mechanism. They had just been stamped with the word confidential, and the appellate court said, you need more than that. You need more than a confidential stamp. And this is clear in this case, that this September 21st letter is the product of a peer review process and is not an ultimate conclusion. The Green case is instructive for us because there's in that case two different sides of the coin, so to speak. There's initially the material related to the nurse's suspension of privileges, and then later the material related to her termination note, where whether it was voluntary or not isn't really discussed, but the trial court had erred in ordering the disclosure of the termination form. But the court found it appropriate to order disclosure of the suspension form because it did not contain a reference to any mechanism of investigation, and it was the hospital's final determination on the issue. And this case, the September 21st, 2023 letter, doesn't meet either of those criteria. It does contain reference to the mechanisms of peer review, and it was not the final determination. I'll move on to the remoteness portion of this. The letter and the suspension at issue are far too remote in time and circumstances from the events at issue in the case that was destined for trial to be discoverable. No aspect of the treatment at issue in this case occurred at a hospital. The events occurred entirely at Dr. Bond's office, and they occurred 10 years before the events concerning his privileges. Even if Dr. Bond had never had hospital privileges, he still would have been able to perform the procedures at issue in the case. And in the Green case, the appellate court determined that even 15 months later, after the events, was too remote. This document, in this case, the September 21st, 2023 peer review letter, is so remote in time from the occurrence at issue that if it had not been for juror misconduct resulting in a mistrial, the entire case would have been over before the suspension even occurred, before the letter was sent. There was nothing to talk about. All the evidence was in. Now, the plaintiff may refer to the Klain case, and plaintiff did refer to Klain in their brief. That was a hospital defendant with a credentialing issue in the case. And there's no hospital defendant in this case. Credentialing is not at issue in this case. In fact, nearly every case that involves the application or non-application of a Medical Studies Act privilege that's cited in the briefs involves hospital defendants. And no hospital was named. None of this care occurred at a hospital. This information couldn't be used for collateral impeachment either, because collateral impeachment is not admissible. What would happen if this information was to be used to impeach Dr. Bond at trial is an entire sub-trial would be brought out for the jury to determine on the merits the comings and goings of Dr. Bond's credentialing issues. That's not an issue in this case. The issue is whether he complied with the standard of care or caused injury in treating Christine Jarrett now close to 15 years ago. Evidence of other bad outcomes is not admissible for impeachment of opinion testimony or credibility, according to the Swift case. Now, I want to move on to the contempt order in this case and whether it should be vacated. And I believe that it should be. Regardless of the court's decision, I believe the court should reverse the order regarding discovery. But regardless of that decision, I believe the contempt order should be vacated because the nondisclosure of this letter was based on a good faith disagreement with the court's decision and not based on any other contempt for the court's authority. No case cited by either party suggests that the conduct of myself and my partner, Mr. Hughes, and our clients merits the sanctions that plaintiff proposes. And plaintiff's response brief regarding the imposition of sanctions against the defendants, there are no cases cited, and there are no cases cited because there's no authority to justify that kind of sanction. This is a procedure concerning discovery disputes with the courts that has been followed appropriately in this case, and the framework is laid out and the case is cited in the briefs to say this is what you do, and that's how this was conducted. The circumstances here were kind of unique because of the timing of the suspension, but the disclosure was made as timely as could be made, and with a good faith review of discovery to make sure that it was asked for, and the delay of the trial occurred kind of by happenstance. This issue would have been disputed if the case was earlier in trial. It had nothing to do with the timing of trial. Plaintiff claims she's at a great disadvantage because she hasn't seen the letter, and that's the nature of privilege disputes.
Mr. Cole, the supplement to your client's deposition testimony said that his privileges had been suspended. So is that a result?
It's not a result. And the trial court determined that the precautionary suspension was a part of an internal review. And that's what had been going on. There was a precautionary suspension placed on the privileges as of the 15th of September. And then there was a subsequent letter on the 21st. I believe that both the letters indicating precautionary suspension and the recommendation of the peer review committee that was subject to a hearing and consideration by the hospital's board of directors were both privileged. But even in a circumstance where the document at issue is not available to a party, it's not appropriate for the party to wildly speculate as to the contents of the document. And I think some of that occurred in plaintiff's brief. The court has seen the letters. The trial court saw the letters, and particularly the September 21st letter that's at issue. And my description of the contents of those letters to the trial court and to the appellate court in the brief are accurate. This letter was part of the peer review process. Plaintiff claims that it was not. And there's a number of cases cited to indicate that the letter and plaintiff's brief that to indicate the letter was not part of the peer review process. Those include Grosslich v. Edward Hospital, Chicago Trust Company, Pietro v. Marriott Senior Living Service, and Nielsen versus Swedish American Hospital. But none of those things that are cited in none of these cases concerning limitations on Medical Studies Act privilege or the situations that are referenced in plaintiff's brief apply here. The record is clear that the court believed the letter was a final determination of the peer review committee and peer review process, and the defendants disagreed. And that's what we're asking the court here today to review, is that determination that this by the trial court, that this was a final determination. There's no evidence that this was from someone not authorized to investigate. There's no evidence that it was outside of the peer review process. There's no evidence it was created in the ordinary course of hospital business. There's no evidence it has a dual purpose for quality assurance and risk management. This is a product of peer review. Plaintiffs suggest that defendants didn't meet our burden, but we have asserted and demonstrated that the letter here was generated by the medical executive committee and used for peer review. And we did so by providing the letters to the trial court, and then we provided it to the appellate court as well. I have nothing further prepared. If there are questions from the panel, I can answer them in my remaining time, or I could defer. I appreciate your time today.
Hey, thank you, counsel. You'll have an opportunity to address us again in the rebuttal. Mr. Smith, on behalf of the appellee, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning.
Morning.
So the issue and the central issue to begin with is that the police in this case are at a severe disadvantage without having the opportunity to look at or see the documents that are in question.
Counsel, isn't that what in-camera review means?
In-camera review does mean that. However, in this case, in order to respond, in order to counter the defendant's conclusory statements that this is privileged, that this is part of the privilege, this is part of the committee, these are all issues that have to be taken at the defendant's word, at the appellant's word, without the benefit of any review of even the supporting documentation.
Again, is that not what in-camera review means? It sounds like you're arguing against the court ever taking a document under review in camera. Because
no.
All of the things that you say flow from that.
I'm not arguing that. The process of an in-camera review was proper. This suggestion that the conclusion by the court was improper is not supported by the defendant because we don't have the documents to determine whether or not there is, for example, we don't have the documents to determine whether or not the committee was made up of qualified individuals that would be subject to the privilege. We don't have any of the documents regarding the committee that made this determination. The letter is the only thing that was submitted, and on its face, the letter says the doctor was suspended. That is a conclusion. That is a determination. And the defendants admitted it, their document A4, with their letter dated April 3rd to our office, says this letter is to further supplement to my correspondence that doctors admitting privileges were suspended.
Well, then what's the purpose of sending it then to the board? And what's the purpose of allowing a hearing?
So the purpose of sending it to the board is the issue that is to be determined as to whether or not that is a conclusion of the committee or not. That determination as to whether or not that was a conclusion of the committee carries the day as to whether or not it was privileged.
Why isn't it a conclusion of the board rather than the committee, whether he'll be suspended?
Because the board is simply a further step as to what happens, whether the doctor can appeal or request a rehearing or reconsideration. It's analogous to if the court comes up with the jury verdict and then it goes to the appellate court. It is, for purposes of privilege, a final determination because the letter on itself, on the face of the letter, apparently says that he was suspended. That is a decision that was made. He can appeal it. He can say, no, you're wrong. He can go to the board and give all the reasons why he shouldn't be suspended, which apparently that's what he did. But for purposes of this panel, determining as to whether or not this is privileged, the first step that you have to take is whether or not it was an actual committee.
I want to follow through on your contention. Sure. that is a result. All you get is the result, and you've been given the result that he was suspended. Now, you may disagree about whether it was final versus precautionary, but all you get is the result. You don't get their analysis that led to the result.
Well, I don't disagree with Your Honor, but the information that comes after the result may or may not be privileged but the trial court made the determination that this document was not privileged and needed to be disclosed. And the trial court, like the appellate court, has the advantage of actually seeing the letter and the supporting documentation, which we don't have. We don't have that advantage. So responding to Your Honor's question, the issue of whether or not the supporting documents or the, I'll call it the subsequent documentation after the suspension is privileged or not privileged, that's an issue to be determined later. The issue for now is this letter and whether or not this letter is privileged. The trial court made that determination.
And if it's not a result, you have to agree, if it's not a result, an action, it's clearly not discoverable. Do you agree with that?
If it was not a conclusion, yes.
Okay.
Agree, but if
so
it's not
if it is a conclusion, what you get is what action was taken. And you know that. That's been provided to you. You don't get the rationale and the thinking that led to the conclusion.
Okay. But
so you really, you've got all you can get.
I respectfully, I disagree. The court has determined that the letter is not privileged. Why don't we get the letter?
Right. I understood, but you're in this court now. So convince us.
Okay. So if this letter is privileged, then we should get it. If it isn't privileged, we shouldn't. The determination by this court in reviewing that decision is a three-step process. Whether or not the committee is a proper committee to provide a basis for privilege, we don't know that. There's been no information, nothing's been submitted to suggest as to whether or not the committee is a proper committee. The document that was provided does not have any additional information other than the letter. Defendants say that they have all this subsequent decisions and all processes. The trial court didn't have that information. They didn't have the ability to review that in its determination. Based on what the trial court has, it's not privileged. And the defendants carry the burden, Your Honors, as to whether or not it is or is not confidential. The mere assertion, simply stating it, well, obviously this is confidential because it's confidential, is not proper. The defendants admit that Dr. Bond's privileges were suspended, and the letter contains a conclusion that, pursuant to the most recent case of Artisana, would in fact support a determination because the letter itself is conclusory. Yes, as defense has argued, there's another step, another process. They can go to the board. The doctor can do a bunch of things, but that doesn't obviously.
You have the conclusion. If it's a conclusion, you have it. What you want is what's your thinking that led to you to do that? And,
right.
And that seems to be where the act comes into play.
But how does the trial court, how is the trial court supposed to make that determination unless they receive all the documents? They didn't get all the documentation. They only got the two letters. One they said was privileged and one they said wasn't.
Well, what would you suggest if it were Judge Smith? How would you make that determination given that the legislature has determined that some of this under certain circumstances shall be privileged?
He made that review. These same arguments that the defense is making today were all before the trial judge. And he made the conclusion that one letter was privileged and one letter was not. And the one letter that was not privileged should be disclosed. This argument, and if I could jump to the next issue, this argument of, well, it's too remote to be relevant. It has nothing to do with the present case. This is a medical treatment that occurred 10 years ago. The defense does not get to make that determination. They don't get to be the judge to determine what's relevant or not relevant. I get the opportunity to argue that.
Make that determination?
Pardon me?
Do we get to make that determination?
You do not. The trial court makes the determination as to whether or not it's relevant for purposes of trial. The trial court is the one that's in the position of determining, based on the evidence that was presented and the arguments of the parties, as to whether or not this information is relevant. That is a separate and distinct issue as to whether or not it is confidential. And the defendant is intermingling these two issues by arguing, well, it's too remote, members of the panel.
Counsel, intermingling is exactly what I thought you were doing. He's made two different arguments. He's made the argument that it's protected under the act, and then he's made the argument that even if it were not protected, it's so remote and it's a subsequent event, it wouldn't have any relevance to your case, arguable relevance. So I don't think he's the one that's intermingling those.
You don't think what? I'm sorry.
I don't think your opponent is the one that's intermingling those. I think you're intermingling the two. He's made them as separate arguments. One is a Medical Studies Act argument. One is a discoverability or a normal discovery argument.
Right. And I'm addressing the issue of remoteness, if I may.
Which is on the discovery part of it.
That's correct. Which is on the discovery part of it.
What is our standard of review, counsel?
Well, as to whether or not it is privileged, I'm sorry, hold on. As to whether or not it is a two-part determination. My apologies. Whether the act's privilege applies is a question of law that is reviewed de novo. However, the question of whether specific materials are part of an internal quality control is a fact question in which defendants bear the burden. So it's a two-part review by this court. The determination of whether the act privilege applies is a question of law, and whether or not the internal or the specific materials that qualify or go along with the privilege, that's a fact question.
If we were to agree with your argument on appeal that the trial court was correct in holding that the act didn't apply, what is your position regarding the contempt that the court found the appellants in?
Well,
what do you advise this court to do on that?
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
What should this court do with regard to the contempt finding?
Yes, I think you should support the motion for contempt. It is not a violation and is an accepted practice for a friendly contempt. That's not our position. The friendly contempt was done correctly by the defendant. The problem is the timing. He waited 6 months after he became aware of this suspension by Dr. Bond, and he waited until 2 months before we were scheduled to retry the case before bringing this to the attention of counsel and the court. That is a basis of finding him in contempt for not providing the information sooner. And that is a basis.
Contempt of which order?
The contempt of the order of failing to provide the
which
document.
Order, which order?
The not turning over the document. That
no, that's the action. What is the order that he violated?
The order that he violated was not turning over the document.
No, you're telling me what he failed to do. What order required him to turn over the document? Oh, that's what contempt means.
Every lawyer has an obligation to timely update and provide information right. That's relevant. And he knew this documentation. Counsel for the defense.
Counsel, he was not held in contempt for doing this late. He was held in contempt for failing to follow Judge Iruli's order that it be turned over. So you're asking that we sustain contempt on a basis that really wasn't the basis that the trial court had.
Your Honor is correct. The contempt was failing to turn over the document. However, we believe that the failure to turn over the document also included an intentional delay in interference with the trial court.
Did the trial court believe that?
Well, we never got a chance to present it because if he doesn't present the issue, strike that. If the court determines it was not privileged, If the court determines that it was privileged, then it's moot. The document doesn't have to be turned over.
Right. Did you ever argue to the trial court that it should find defendant in contempt for failing to disclose the existence of the suspension sooner than he did?
We did not. Yeah, we did not make that argument.
However, is that your argument on appeal?
Pardon me?
Is that your argument on appeal to this court?
On that particular issue or the whole, are you asking?
Well, what you just said, that you didn't argue to the trial court, are you arguing it to us?
I am, because I think this court can make recognize the defendant's acts of waiting 6 months when they had knowledge of it and 2 months before the trial. I'm asking this court for sanctions. Absolutely. As part of.
Well, counsel, now you're blending sanctions and contempt.
Well, I'm asking for sanctions as part of the review by this court for the delay. And it's in my brief and we asked for it. It's not something that's surprising or I'm bringing it up for the first time today. That's part of our brief and our request.
Well, we're a court of review, counsel, and it's odd when you're seeking relief based on a particular basis that it sounds to me like you never raised with the trial court.
Again, I'm not sure I could raise it if the court had made the determination on the issue or question of confidentiality. Because if the court found that this document was, in fact, confidential, then it's not interfering. It has nothing to do with the trial because I won't be able to raise it at the next trial.
Okay, but he did find it should be disclosed. Why didn't you raise it then?
Well, I didn't in writing.
Right. And you're aware that you're not supposed to raise a new issue on appeal that you didn't raise in the trial court.
Well, we raised the issue of the failure to disclose. You're right. We did not raise the specific issue in terms of the timing of the knowledge at 6 months and 6 months of knowledge and 2 months before the trial. Court's absolutely correct. We did not raise that with the trial court at the time. I think I've argued this, but I want to make sure that I have addressed the issue of whether or not the letter will be determined on the question of relevancy and whether or not it'd be admissible at the time of trial. If the court supports the trial court's conclusion that this is not privileged and should be disclosed in its entirety, the court will then make a determination what, if any, other supporting documents or conclusory documents or anything else that would be part of the privilege review, that will be determined by the trial court as well. That is a completely separate issue as to whether or not a jury in the second trial will ever hear this, will ever know about it, because the issue of relevancy will be determined through either a motion in limine or a pretrial discussion between the parties in the court. So again, I think this panel should disregard any arguments of remoteness or issues of whether or not Dr. Bond's actions could or might be remotely connected to the allegations in our case. There, from the little bit that we understand, that this may be the result of repeated acts on the part of Dr. Bond. It was the result of something that occurred in his office, which would necessarily refer to office procedures, which is an issue in our case. And it may have to do with his act or acts as it applies to one patient or different patient. The issue in the underlying case involves his failure to not only provide medical care, but in terms of his administration of his office and the notes and the records that he kept in terms of his treatment of my client. All of those questions may be impacted by the reason and the determination of the suspension of Dr. Bond. In addition, I asked Dr. Bond during the discovery deposition if his privileges had ever been suspended. He said no. Now that his privileges have been suspended.
It was true at the time, though, right?
Yes, and if I may, it was true at the time, but Dr. Bond has an obligation, a continuing obligation, to update any and all discovery when he knew about the fact that he had been suspended, whether it was a day, a month, or a year. He had an obligation to disclose it and violated that obligation. That is an issue that is in this case and is part and parcel of the question of this letter. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, counsel. Mr. Cole, on behalf of the appellant, you may make the rebuttal arguments if you wish.
Thank you. I want to first address the relevance question that Mr. Smith was talking about, the scenarios that he brought up of things that could be discussed at trial. None of those things would be admissible. They're all collateral issues, not related to care and treatment at issue in this case. And
if he testifies as an expert, can he be impeached with his subsequent or with his prior suspension?
Potentially. However, not concerning factual cases, not do you have a pattern of this or a pattern of that? And that's what Mr. Smith was discussing. His testimony as an expert could be potentially impeached by prior discipline or a final determination by a hospital, but I don't know that that would be applicable here. And also the remoteness portion of this is worthy of review. And Justice Steigman asked Mr. Smith what the standard of review is for that question. And the answer to that question is it's an abuse of discretion standard. It's set forth in the Green case when in Green, the appellate court found it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to order disclosure of a document that was too remote to lead to relevant evidence.
The judge, I really pass on the question of remoteness. How can we say he abused his discretion if he never got to that issue?
Well, it appears he did get to the issue and found that it was sufficiently remote to be discoverable. Judge, I really was kind of between a rock and a hard place as far as the timing of this is concerned, and I'm sympathetic to him, but he made a mistake. I believe what his intention was to address privilege, and if it's not privilege, it's discoverable, and if it is privilege, it's not, and then wait later to address relevance. And that I understand that strategy, but it's not what's appropriate under Illinois law. And the Green case indicates if you've got something that's so remote as to not lead to relevant evidence, it's okay to not order its disclosure. In fact, it's an abuse of discretion to order its disclosure. And that is what occurred. That's the error that we're claiming. I want to talk a little bit about the timing too. Plaintiff made no interrogatories or requests for production concerning hospital admission privileges. It's not strange that that didn't happen because no care in this case occurred at a hospital. However, at Dr. Bond's discovery deposition, there was an isolated question and answer. Have your hospital admission privileges ever been suspended or revoked? And the answer was no. So at the time of the suspension in September of 2023, I engaged in a review of the written discovery in this case and determined the question hasn't been asked. It's not relevant. It's not likely to be relevant. It doesn't need to be disclosed. And then down the road, preparing for trial, I'm going through Dr. Bond's deposition testimony, and I come across this question and this answer.
This is likely not information in the record, though, counsel.
I believe it was argued to the mm-hmm. trial court. It's in the record, certainly in my brief. And that was the basis for making the disclosure at the time it was made. A review was conducted in good faith of the discovery, and it was determined, oh, this does need to be disclosed, and it was disclosed. And the fact that it was disclosed months ahead of trial as opposed to not at all or on the eve of trial suggests good faith to my mind.
Can I ask you, though, counsel, when you make a Medical Studies Act objection to production, isn't it incumbent on you to provide the court with the policies and counsel with the policies that govern the decision making, that show us who the committees are?
Well, the trial court
is just submitting the document.
The trial court in this case was satisfied that that prong of this had been met by the content of the letters, because the trial court determined that the 15th letter was privileged.
What's the basis for that if we don't have the policies?
I don't have access to the policies as a defendant. I'm not a hospital defendant. And I gave the court what I could.
Hey, thank you, counsel. Your time is up. The court will take this matter under advisement and issue a written decision in due course.